You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Quick! What does the word Taino mean to you? Can't every American school child tell you? Most Americans are unfamiliar with the name of the Caribbean tribe that believed that their island was the earliest part of the creation. And therefore, the sun and the moon every day rose up out of a cave on its northmost coast. On the other hand, most Americans know today as Columbus Day, at least in 47 states, although Hawaii has renamed it Discoverer's Day after the original Polynesians who populated that island thousands of years ago. South Dakota calls it Native American Day, and Alaska just ignores it, like pretty much everything else. But what we're really celebrating today is Happy Taino Genocide Day, the day when Christopher Columbus began to wipe out an entire indigenous population in a way that would even make Pol Pot blush. In 1492, Columbus was on a manic hunt for gold when he set sail and eventually landed on a small island off the coast of North and South America, an island today known as Hispaniola, which is split between the nations of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And as he wrote in a letter to the King and Queen of Spain, gold is most excellent. Gold constitutes treasure. And he who has it does all he wants in the world and can even lift souls up to paradise. But when he landed in what he called the New World, there wasn't much gold. But he did find something he thought was just as good as gold, people, who, in Columbus's mind, would make great slaves. So he wrote to the Spanish monarch, quote, "They are well built, with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms, do not know them. For I showed them a sword, they took it by the edge, and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron, their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. And here there are so many of these slaves, although they are living things, they are as good as gold." End of quote from Christopher Columbus. What Columbus did to the island and the tragedy he brought to the native population there has been largely erased by time and replaced by a glorified story of a bold explorer who changed the planet. In reality, though, as a result of what we've learned from writings by Christopher Columbus's own men, he raped, pillaged, enslaved, and slaughtered people just to get rich. Not exactly the type of guy worthy of a Main Street parade. One of Columbus's crewmen, Miguel Cueno, described the scene when Columbus arrived in Hispaniola for the second time, and thousands of Taínos, or what were referred to as Indians, came out to greet the ships. Cueno writes, "When our caravels," that's the ships, "were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of those Indians. For those who remained," that is for the Spaniards who were staying on the island, "we let it be known to the Spaniards in the vicinity that anyone who wanted to take some of them," that is the slaves, "could do so to the amount desired," which was done. Cueno went on to write that he took his own sex slave, a beautiful teenage girl who, in his own words, quote, "resisted with all her strength," end quote, leaving him no other choice but to, quote, "thrash her mercilessly and rape her," end quote. And when Columbus's men did good work, Columbus routinely presented them with their very own sex slaves. But that was just the beginning. Columbus eventually started up a global child sex slave trade, exporting young Indians all around the world. As he bragged to a friend in a letter written in 1500, 100 castellanos, that's a Spanish coin, are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm. And it is very general, and there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are now in demand, end quote, from Christopher Columbus. Eventually, under Columbus's orders, life for the Taino on their homeland of Hispaniola got so bad that they resorted to mass suicide. As the Spanish missionary Pedro Cordoba noted in 1517, 25 years after Columbus arrived, quote, "As a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians choose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally, 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery," end quote. By the time Cordoba wrote those words, the indigenous population on Hispaniola had plummeted from roughly 3 million people before Columbus arrived to only 12,000 people 25 years later. A few decades after that, not one was left on the island. An entire culture and people completely wiped off the map and largely forgotten, thanks to Christopher Columbus. Happy Taino Genocide Day. I propose we rename Columbus Day Taino Genocide Day or Native American Genocide Day. I mean, take your pick. Some variation thereof. By the way, this is a remarkable thing. Today Mitt Romney is going after Barack Obama on national security, which I find just hysterical. This actually kind of tragic. I mean, this is Mitt Romney who said, no, we shouldn't help them get Gaddafi out. We shouldn't do that. And then we did. And now he's like, we should help them get, Bashir out of Syria, and Bashir Assad. Yeah. Bashir al-Assad out of Syria. There's a real interesting piece in today's New York Times about how he's got like warring factions within his foreign policy advisors. Because he has no opinions. He's taken no stance. This is nothing he's ever paid attention to. The international scene. We know from, when he was talking to a room full of billionaires that he said that his solution to the Middle East would be to ignore it for 4 or 8 years and hope that it would resolve itself. And if it didn't, pass it along to the next president. Right. Really smart. So we'll see how that plays out. But there's this great threat over at DU, at Democratic Underground. The president was warned security was lacking and did nothing, which is something that Mitt Romney is going to and his minions already have attacked President Obama about with regard to the four people who died in the embassy and in Libya. And at DU, I figured, okay, this has got to be, they've got to be, talking about Bush. Bush was warned 9/11 was coming and did nothing. Didn't raise the threat status, didn't call a national security advisor's meeting. I mean, he was first born on May 1st of 2001. May, June, July, August, September, that's 5 months. Four and change, right? So from May 1st. So that's what I figured that they were going to talk about, but instead it's from a clip from a news story from 1983. In the attack on the American Marine barrack, the death toll was 241 American servicemen, 220 Marines, 18 sailors, and 3 soldiers, along with 60 Americans injured, representing the deadliest single-day death toll for the United States Marine Corps since the Battle of Iwo Jima of World War II. The deadliest single-day death toll for the United States military since the first day of the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War, and the ugliest single attack on Americans overseas since World War II. President Reagan, who had been warned that this was going to happen and done nothing, pulled everybody out of Lebanon and said, okay, that's it, we're out of there. Which was actually probably the smart thing to do. It's funny how I keep looking back on the Reagan presidency and finding these little, Reagan raised taxes 11 times. Reagan threw banksters in jail when the SNLs melted down. Reagan, when he was confronted by terrorists in Lebanon, said, okay, that's it. Screw it. We're out of Lebanon. Right? There's nothing, what are we doing here anyway? There's no oil. I guess that was probably the equation.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how are you going to celebrate Taino Genocide Day, Columbus Day today? What are you up to? Give us a shot. Let us know. Quote for the day, is from Chief Segwalis of the Iroquois Confederacy. He said, ours was a wealthy society. No one suffered from want. All had the right to food, clothing, and shelter. All shared in the bounty of the spiritual ceremonies in the natural world. No one stood in any material relationship of power over anyone else. No one could deny anyone access to the things they needed. All in all, before the colonists came, ours was a beautiful and rewarding way of life. And, you know, this is something that if you take, like, Thomas Jefferson's diaries and juxtapose them with Jared Bernstein's Guns, Germs, and Steel, you know, the early European look at Native Americans, and I mean, it wasn't the super early, but it was one of the early ones. And then check out Peter Farb's book, Man's Rise to Civilization, which is, I think, the best ethnography, the best, you know, social look at how the Native Americans in North America lived at point of first contact, at the time that they were first encountered by Europeans. What you get, and then you look at the history of the North American continent and what happened to the sloth, the three-toed sloth, and what happened to the North American version of the woolly mammoths, and you know what happened to the saber-toothed tigers, and where'd they all go? And it sure looks like, if you look at the historical record and you look at the geologic record, that human beings came to North America 20 to 30,000 years ago, and I think that, you know, there's a consensus forming that there was, you know, possibly one wave that came into South America from, actually by sea, and another wave that came over the Bering Strait from the north. But in any case, Asians came to North America between 20 and 30,000 years ago and proceeded to basically wipe out much of the ecosystem of at least the North American continent, at least our part, you know, the United States part, the really temperate, comfortable part of the North American continent. And the result of that was environmental collapse in a lot of places. I mean, there were major, like, mound building down in what is now New Orleans. They were building pyramids that in some cases were almost as big as the pyramids in Egypt. They were just made out of brick so that they weathered away, although some of them still exist. I mean, they're all over North America, actually. And so, you know, you had these elaborate societies, and they died at their own hand by destroying their ecosystem and by killing off the large animals that could be prey. And what came out of that was a forehead slap and a holy cow, how did we do this to ourselves? And what came out of that was, let's figure out a way to live that makes sense. And in the case of the Iroquois, for example, there was this fellow, the Stutterer, was his name in English. I am sorry, I'm doing this from memory, not from notes. I don't have I can't remember his name. It's a long, difficult to pronounce name in the original Iroquois. His assistant, the fellow who spoke on his behalf, was named Hiawatha, not the one of Longfellow's poem. And he came to the Iroquois people and, you know, as kind of a Jesus-like figure, basically, or at least in legend, said, here's how to live. You know, here's how to make things happen. Okay. If you're trying to call in, or if you tried to call in, by the way, just, you know, our phone system just crashed and we're rebooting it, so give us a shout back. In any case, he basically came and he said, okay, here's the system. You know, much like Moses, and, you know, here are the laws. And one of the laws is, anything you do, you have to do thinking of what its consequence will be. Any decision you make, you must make in the context of the seventh generation from now. In other words, we don't leave this earth to our children. We are borrowing it from them. And not just our children, but our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren, and so forth. Seven generations down. And that was the core of most of the law of the Iroquois Confederacy. And so they ended up with a three-branch governmental system. Basically a legislature, a judiciary, and an executive, as it were. branch. The executive was the most obligated to everybody person. It's really interesting when you look at the power relationships in the Iroquois Confederacy, and this is like really, really well documented. Peter Farb did a brilliant job of documenting it, but I wrote about it at some length in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I went back and Jefferson wrote about this in his diaries. I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. If you were the chief, that meant that you had the greatest obligation to everybody. You were the poorest. Anything you owned belonged to everybody. You were the person, and because nobody was wealthy. I mean, everybody shared everything. There was this genuine sense of community and a genuine sense of obligation. And when people started trying to lock up the food, when people started hoarding things, when people, the Iroquois identified that as a mental illness. They did away with, and those people ultimately, if they couldn't be cured, they were banished. They also did away with war. They still had to have ways of solving tribal conflicts, intertribal conflicts, and interclan conflicts, and they did it with a game that they invented that we still play in North America. It's called lacrosse. And in fact, hanging in the National Gallery here in Washington, D.C., is this giant painting that was painted like in the 1830s or 1850s of this giant Iroquois Confederacy battle. 10,000, young warriors playing lacrosse. It was a four-day lacrosse game. I mean, it's really, so it's like they had this, they created this eco-side, this, they destroyed their environment, they learned from it, and came up with a sustainable way of living. That's what gives me hope for us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because just personally, I think we're kind of reliving the whole thing, and we're on the edge of ecological, economic, and human disasters that we will wake up from.
On the boats and on the planes, they're coming to America.
Yeah.
Never looking back.
Yeah. And the people in the Iroquois Confederacy go, whoa, who's that? And not just the Iroquois, of course. This Native American Day in South Dakota. I salute you, South Dakota. Remarkable. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Manny in Fairfield, Connecticut. Hey, Manny, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. Yeah, I had recall the reading up on the Northwest Indians up there in Washington State, that whole area where they were using for their wood canoes. Rather than fell a cedar tree, they would erect a scaffold around the tree and peel off one side or a quarter to get a slab, a plank, maybe 40, 50 feet high, 15 inches wide, 4 inches thick, and then move to another tree, leaving enough for the tree to grow itself back. Responsibly harvest their lumber from these old growth forests. And every 6 or 8 years, they would revisit a tree that they had previously used and take another slab.
Wow.
And I just thought that was mind-blowing that they would, say, hey, let's leave it standing, take only what we need.
Yeah.
And we'll have more for next generation.
Yeah. Well, it's like down in Brazil, there was a tribe of Indians that I recount in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, where they lived in the jungle, and they would take a circle of a few hundred yards and fell the trees in toward the center, and then and basically clear that land out, and then they as it grew back, there would be different kinds of vegetation that would grow at different times, and the small stuff and the medium stuff and the large stuff and whatnot, and they planted things like sweet potatoes and things, but the stuff that they planted was all coexisting with the local environment. And they would live there for a year or so, and then they'd move on to another spot. And eventually, after 5 or 10 years, they'd end up back where they started. And what this did was it actually provided diversity and nutrients to the ecosystem. That, the modern humans are the only – we are the only species whose waste is not the food for something else. And by our waste, I'm not talking about our excrement. I'm talking about things like, you know, nuclear waste and, you know, giant steel buildings, although arguably over time those will be food for something else. They will eventually biodegrade. But a lot of what we produce...
And then the corporate raiders came to the Northwest, and our redwood stands went the way of the buffalo.
Yeah, yeah, good story.
Clear cut to stumps, acres and acres and miles, as you could see.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for the call, Manny. Good to hear from you. Paul in Fairfield, Oklahoma. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind? No? No, Paul? Okay. Randall in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Tom, thank you for taking my call. Take no more than you need. I live just south of La Crosse, which was, the game was actually named after the area of the town. A lot of people don't realize that. But the corporate raiders here have kept the gas prices so high because of they misfigured some gasoline in the Midwest about 2 months ago. It caused over 100,000 cars to die. And with the oil companies being in collusion, they've maintained the price of gasoline across the nation a lot higher than it would have been at, say, $80 a barrel, which we currently are at.
Well, there's fairly strong evidence, too, that two other things are driving our gas prices up. The first is that the number one export right now in the United States is gasoline, gasoline and diesel fuel. We are the that's our largest export. And if you export a lot of gasoline, it reduces your domestic supplies, which drives up the price. So we're refining like crazy, but we're exporting most of it, or not most of it. We're exporting enough of it to drive prices up. And then the second is trading on the commodities exchanges, you know, using gasoline futures as a commodity, as something to trade by people who will not take delivery, who will never take delivery. And that may account for as much as, I've heard different numbers, 25 cents to a dollar of the cost of gasoline right now, a significant percentage of it. So,
and yeah. Those are mostly major banks that are backing that.
Well, it's the banksters, and then there's these traders on Wall Street with names that you've never heard of, individual names and company names, where they pay an enormous sum to the New York Stock Exchange to be able to have their computers right next door to the exchange. I mean, literally a cable run of an extra few feet puts them at a disadvantage to the next company over. And then what they do is they run these computers so super, super fast that they're basically interacting with the New York Stock Exchange computers in instant real time and trading thousands of stocks a second and able to do that because of these short cable runs and thus, you know, skim a little money off the top. So if you're trading oil futures, and you're trading thousands of hundreds, you know, millions of barrels a second in thousands of exchanges, thousands of trades. Each trade you may, you know, make or lose a penny or half a penny or a thousandth of a penny or whatever. But you add it up over time and it becomes billions and billions of dollars that they're basically skimming off the top as they drive up the price of the commodity. And that's the name of the game, is drive up the price of the commodity.
And collusion leads to taking more than you need.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. It is a symptom of our collective mental illness. Well said, Randall. Thank you very much for the call. Very well said. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Hey, quick question for you. I wanted to ask you, how long have you been a vegetarian for?
Since I was 17.
Which yeah.
Would be a little more than 40 years.
I think that if anybody's talking about anything that has to do with the environment, the single biggest thing we can do is adopt a vegetarian diet, and I don't see that a lot of people are talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the problems, well, you know, I have a number of times on the show, but you're right, Jason, and good point, well made. And in fact, I mean, you know, here we are, 7 billion humans on the earth, and only about 1.5 billion of us, maybe 2 billion, eat any, you know, meat of consequence. The rest of, most of the citizens of the world are vegetarian, not by choice, but because, you know, that's the only protein available to them is vegetable protein. And, I mean, there, of course, there are entire religions. You know, the Buddhism is a vegetarian religion. Hinduism is a vegetarian religion that were vegetarian and adapted to that, I think, you know, appropriately so, and probably out of ecological disasters as well back, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 years ago, I'm guessing. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. Tommy in Mecca, California. Hey, Tommy, what's on your mind?
Tom, see, I wanted to thank you for this topic of indigenous people, for you talking about that subject here. This is really good. I know that here in California they celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm-hmm. Up in places like Berkeley in the Bay Area.
Yes, there are a number of cities that have adopted it, along with the state of South Dakota.
Well, the last island that Columbus left when he took off from Europe was the island of Gomera in the Canary Islands. And the indigenous population in the Canary Islands were also living in the Stone Age, and they were completely wiped out by the Spanish, too. And they were actually fair-skinned and had beards and blue eyes and blonde hair. And in a lot of the chronicles, they said that when Columbus and these early navigators reached the Caribbean and the Americas, there was a lot of people that were described as what you call white and Caucasian, and there was also very African-looking people with dark skin and kinky hair. And so I think the idea of, like, indigenous people probably is kind of a, like, a multiracial theme.
Yeah.
That indigenous people come in all kinds of colors, and that there's a website called whiteindians.com, and it talks about the Canary Islanders, and it also talks about the people on the other side of the Atlantic.
Why, and the assumption that they're like remnants of the Leif Erikson expeditions in 500?
Well,
or something?
Probably goes back way farther than that, because some of them proto-Indo-European languages, like in Chepo-Thule tribe in Panama, they built pyramids and such. This has more to do with what you think of as like Thor Heyerdahl when he crossed the Atlantic Ocean in 1970 in a paper boat.
Right. The thing that I find amazing is when we lived in Vermont, there was a society, a group of amateur historians and archaeologists who got together every month, and they went out and they looked at these sites, and I subscribed to their newsletter. I was in a couple of their meetings, and Louise and I went to one of the sites. There are sites all over New England, and I'm guessing they're all over America, but this group was just Vermont, New Hampshire. There are sites all over Vermont, New Hampshire that are virtually identical to Stonehenge. They are stone sites that are calendar stones, basically, where, you know, if you stand on a particular stone on the spring or fall, winter, summer solstice, spring and fall equinox, then, you know, the light hits a particular stone in a particular way, and you know that that's that moment in time. And this is something that, I mean, there's hundreds of these across North America.
No, I've seen those pictures of those. Those are definitely in New England, and that's pretty well known. And also the mounds up the Mississippi River and Ohio and those things.
Yeah.
There's one theory that there was an ice bridge that went from what we now call France to the New World, and people from France crossed the Atlantic Ocean 17,000 years ago, the Solutrians. Mm-hmm. It was called Ice Age Columbus on the Discovery Channel. They showed it's on YouTube, and some of the first people to come here and bring the Solutrian spear points were these light-skinned indigenous people that had to hunt seals because the ice bridge had gone so far south in Europe that there was nothing left to eat.
Yeah.
So they ended up in North America 17,000 years ago.
Yeah, it's really an amazing. You get into that, you know, looking at ancient history. How did this happen? How did that happen? I'm still also curious about the Neanderthals, you know, who died out 20, 30,000 years ago in Europe. And it seems now they're looking at the genetic makeup of them, and they've discovered that some people have Neanderthal genes, and particularly people who have red hair. And, you know, that seems to be something that came from the Neanderthals, which takes us back to Greg Bear and Darwin's radio and the idea that maybe they were even smarter than we are. Tommy, thank you for the call. And also, you know, how societies, you know, grow and vanish. I got to tell you an amazing story about a Native American, but a fellow by the name of Frank. It's been a year or two since I've told this story, so I'll tell it after we come back from the break. An amazing learning that I had.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Happy Taino Genocide Day. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman.
He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test.
I hadn't heard that one before. Oh, yes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Debbie Kempel is on the line. Debbie is a community member in Freeport, Illinois, a.k.a. Bainport. Bainport, BAINPORT.com is the website. You need to check this out if you're looking for something to speak about, know about, tweet about, blog about, Facebook about, tell everybody you know about and do something about. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I understand that some folks were arrested. This is Sensata. This is the company that Mitt Romney's Bain company has taken over and is shipping the factory to China block by block, machine by machine. And so what's going on there today?
Well, we had gotten word that they were going to be moving equipment out this morning. And so I, a bunch of us, probably 12 people total, we were all there ready to stop the truck, and the semi did come up. And unfortunately, we almost all, I kid you not, almost all got hit. This is a big semi with a backhoe on it and another packaged piece of machinery on the trailer, and he was not going to stop. We made our line, and he honestly kept moving. He, yeah, it was really, that was really, really pretty scary. That was scarier than being hauled off to jail, which happened to me a few minutes later.
Wow. So you were hauled off to jail, presumably for obstructing the truck from hauling the Sensata equipment off to China?
Yeah, it was actually a non-compliance because they had asked us to break our line, and we would not do it because we did not want that truck to go by. And so we wouldn't, there were some of them, they left the line, but there were three of us that actually three generations. It was really interesting. An 81-year-old, and I'm 59, and then there was a 16-year-old. We stood our ground, and they gave us a choice. They said, they asked us very, very politely to move, or we would be arrested, and we would not move. We did not move. So the three of us got handcuffed and taken to the local jail.
Remarkable. And, Debbie, what can people do who want to support what you're doing?
Oh, you know, get to Bainport.com. Mm-hmm. Everything that has happened from, well, probably the end of June, if not, there's an encampment here at Bainport, which is the Stevenson County Fairgrounds in Freeport, Illinois. This is the 29th day of encampment, and there have been people that have stayed every single night. And get on Bainport.com, and it'll tell you what you can do and where we need help, and just, if for no other reason, just to support these jobs not being shipped
there you
to China.
Go. Debbie Kemple, Debbie, I honor your activism and your commitment to keeping your job and your organization, your company and your community. It's a shame that Bain wouldn't consider selling or giving, for that matter, that company to its employees.
Right, yes, that's correct, yes.
There
yes,
are so many
you.
Good options. So, Debbie Kemple, thank you for being with us. And
thank you very much.
Okay, great talking.
I know.
And people need to be sure to go check out Bainport.com. It's a great site. So, Frank, I was invited to a harvest gathering up in upstate New York. It was put together by a local community newspaper, and the woman who ran that was married to a Native American, and they did this harvest gathering every year. In fact, I think they still do it. Carol Bedrosian is her name. She publishes this paper. And she had brought in people from representing tribes basically all over the world. And from South America and the U.S. and Africa, and I was the white guy, the you know European ancestry white guy tribe, and so we had this talking circle one evening, and there was a big fire, and we're sitting around the fire, a group of the elders, right? I was one of the elders, and then outside the group of the elders, there were a couple hundred young people who were sitting around, you know, listening to the elders speak. And this Native American guy by the name of Frank was sitting next to me. He was from a tribe in Canada with a name that is very long and I can neither remember nor pronounce at the time. And Frank pointed out in the crowd, he said, you know, look at all these young white kids wearing buckskin. He said, they're dressing up like Indians. He said, why would they want to be like us? He said, we have been crushed. We've been killed. We've been, you know, genocided. The greatest poverty in North America is on your Native American communities, whether it's in Canada or the United States. He said, why would they want to be like us? And I said, and I just got a sudden revelation, and I just had to share it with Frank in that moment. I said, Frank, you know the story of your mother's 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 all the way back to the beginning of time, basically, to the beginning of your tribe, thousands, tens of thousands of years ago. And he said, yes. And I said, and you know the sacred directions and the sacred words and the sacred prayers, and they've been passed down from generations long before there was writing or things like that. And he said, yes. And I said, can you imagine? And I said, you know the language that was spoken by your people 5,000, 10,000 years ago? And he was like, yes, of course. And I said, well, these young people who are dressed in buckskin of European ancestry, imagine how horrible it would be if your language had been taken away from you, and I know the Europeans tried to do that, and if your religion had been taken away from you, and I know they tried to do that, but if they'd been successful and you had been left with nothing, no memory of anything. And he got this just very, very horrified look on his face, and he said that would be a tragedy beyond description. And I said, well, I went back to my grandparents' home in Norway, and there's a stone in the backyard of that house that has writing on it that's not even 2,000 years old that nobody today can read. You know, the 3,000 years ago, the Celts swept across Europe and wiped out the tribal people or organized them for trading purposes, let them keep their language. And then 2,000 years ago, the Romans came across, let them keep their language, but made them change, or let them keep their religion, but made them change their language. And then 1,000 years ago, the Catholic Church conquered all of Europe. And they took, you know, took away their religion. Nobody remembers anything. And Frank looked out at the crowd and he said, my God, you're a tribe of hungry ghosts. I was like, yeah.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, whoops. And just a second here. Welcome. Dr. Art Kaplan is on the line with us, but my call screen software just crashed. There we go. Got it back. Dr. Kaplan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Very, very good. Very pleased to have you with us. You are the Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the Department of Population Health at New York University Langone Medical Center, and the author of numerous books, and we've got a link to your website, pophealth.med.nyu.edu, off on our homepage as well. And Dr. Kaplan, and also for NBC News, this story, Grace is this young woman's name, 28 years old, Soong-yun Grace Lee, is dying in a Long Island hospital. Can you set up the story for us? Tell us what's going on.
So this is really a sad, sad tale. Probably about a year ago, Grace Lee was a pretty active, vibrant woman getting ready for New York City Marathon, 28 years old, living independently. She had a seizure, went into the hospital out on Long Island, and they diagnosed a rare but really nasty brain tumor. It is eating away at the part of her brain known as the cerebellum. That controls basically bodily functions, bodily movement. For listeners trying to get a handle on this, think Stephen Hawking kind of fate for her.
It's going to basically paralyze from the neck down.
Paralyzed from the neck down, not able to communicate with much more than eyebrows and movement and a little mouthing of words. Cognitively, however, still there. She's certainly not impaired in that part of her brain at all.
She's fully awake and aware. She just can't move anything.
Correct.
And go ahead.
So maybe, I don't know, September, maybe a month ago now, she had a bunch of serious seizures, had to go into the hospital. This seems to be the end game here, because eventually this will cause her to die. All functions will shut down and she'll die. She's on a respirator now because she can't breathe on her own, and she's on a feeding tube. Mm-hmm. So she has parents, one of whom is a minister. I should add, this is a Korean-American family, very close in their way. Mm-hmm. The dad is a fundamentalist Christian minister. The mom seemingly also very religious, and they've been coming in to visit her. She told the doctors, I don't want to live anymore. You're prolonging my dying with this machinery. I've had it. Let me die. Mm-hmm. The parents basically have said, you can't do that. to their daughter, saying this is suicide. We don't approve of you shutting off the machines. It's the work of Satan to have you do this, and really coming on very strongly with her to try and discourage her from doing anything that would cause her to turn off those machines.
So the question in my mind is, why does the church, or a church, this is a Protestant, a small Protestant church,
mm-hmm.
Why does a church have the right to tell you how and when to die? And then I suppose there's a second, you know, bundle, ethical bundle wrapped up in this, which is that this is the way her father makes his living, is by telling people how to live their lives. And part of how he tells them to live their lives includes telling them how and when they can die. And so if he allows his daughter to have her own wishes, he will have diminished his own income. I mean, his own living. He will have gone against what he's, you know, it's as if you were a Chevy salesman and you were driving a Lexus.
So I'll buy that, and I'll say this. Let's presume it's good faith. He believes that it is not allowable for someone to turn off their machines or say, I've had enough. Unfortunately, that puts him squarely at odds with law and ethics in America, which say an adult person, a 28-year-old woman, is absolutely free to decide to say, I've had it. I don't want any more chemotherapy. I don't want any blood transfusions, by the way, in the name of a Jehovah's Witness. Mm-hmm. Some people refuse things on religious grounds. I don't want any more ventilator. I want to be allowed to go. You have that right. No parent can override it. No one can override it. As long as you're competent and know what's going on and understand the consequences, then he, the minister, should not be in a position to do anything regarding his daughter's decision. On the other hand, because of the family dynamic and probably some cultural angle here, I'm sure she wants to please them and she's worried about leaving them upset. And so this weekend, believe it or not, she announced she is not going to have the ventilator removed.
Hmm.
So she has changed her mind. Her lawyer, or guardian, I should say, who is asked to represent her independently at the hospital, confirms that. So just so listeners are clear, an adult person, your parents can't tell you what to do about much of anything, but certainly not your medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Can your parents come in and browbeat you and guilt you and almost coerce you into something? Well, they probably can, and that bothers me that that's going on here, because she was pretty clear about she wanted, and all of a sudden, I hate to use this term, but she's had a kind of deathbed conversion.
Mm-hmm. And her father, being a minister, is in the business of persuading people about their belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I keep coming back to that. Not that I view ministers as villains. In fact, I think that there's a certain nobility in for many people, you know, in that kind of a calling. But at what point, you know, does to take this out of the context of just the family? At what point does even if it wasn't her father telling her? I mean, what if it was just the church that her father represented telling her? Because my understanding, Dr. Arthur Kaplan, is that her father is of the opinion, or has informed her, that if she turns off the ventilator, she will go to hell.
Correct.
And if she goes to hell, mom and dad are going to go to heaven, and they will not be together in the afterlife, and that's the big concern. Do I have that right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So, there's also an issue here of, religion controlling our human behavior in ways that actually increases human suffering, and I thought it was supposed to work the other way around.
Right. So my view is, when you have a dying daughter, I don't think you need to give her the straight to hell speech if you shut this thing off. I think you need to try and accommodate around what your dying daughter is bearing, the burden she has. And remember, turning off a machine, I don't care what a particular religious perspective might be, is not the same as a suicide.
Right.
A suicide is somebody who's going to kill themselves, who isn't going to die anyway, who isn't under any medical treatment. They're going to take some action to end their lives. And we could debate about whether that's right or wrong. But here's a woman who's saying, it's not that I want to die. I don't want to be like this, and I don't want this medical technology to prolong my dying, because that's where she's at. It's not like she's going to get better next week from this technology. It's stringing out her nine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the parent, the dad, has it wrong. Whatever they think about suicide and what that means in the afterlife, I don't think they're describing this correctly.
And what would be the correct way to describe it?
I'm dying. The machines are extending my dying. Maybe I don't want to die, but I don't want to live like this, so I'd like my medical treatment stopped. If I die, so be it. If I don't, we'll have something else to think about. There's no guarantee if you pull the ventilator out, she's going to be dead in a second. So it might mean she's going to die sooner. I wouldn't deny that, and that's probably what she wants. But it does not mean that she is somehow saying, yes, I wish to end my own life. Please come and inject me like Dr. Kevorkian with an overdose or something.
So
what
this
she's saying is, I'm dying anyway.
Right. So this is, in your mind and legally, this is not a suicide.
Not at all.
Very, very interesting. What an ethical dilemma. Dr. Arthur Kaplan, thank you so much for your perspective on this, sir.
Hey, my pleasure.
And what's the title of your most recent book?
So the most recent one is Smart Mice, Not So Smart People, which in this election season may have more traction than I thought it would.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Kaplan. Great talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So when does and why does the church have the right to tell you when and how to die, and how do we deal with that narcissism? Tom, I'm here with you. Tom in Chicago. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to run something by you and get your opinion on this.
Mm-hmm.
Being in Chicago, near the Great Lakes, it's often occurred to me that we are we are to water what the Middle East is to oil with fresh water. And if I'm not mistaken, we have about 30% of the world's fresh water here in the Great Lakes, if I'm not mistaken.
I remember that it's huge. I mean, I grew up in Michigan, so we were told this constantly. I think that number is really, really large, but it is a huge amount of water, in particularly Lake Superior.
Well, my fear.
My what? His phone just went. Tom? No, Tom. Alfredo, are you on the air? Are you there? Our phone just croaked. Oh, my. Okay. Well, it looks like we're going to have to reboot our phone system again. Oh, man. Of course, it's a holiday, and our phone company is not doing a really fast job of answering the phone. So my apologies if you've tried to call in and not gotten through. I'm going to close my window here, and please, Shane, let me know when it's back up and when people can call back in, because we're going to reboot the whole system. So anyway, today is Columbus Day. Our quote for the day from Chief Seguales of the Iroquois: ours was a wealthy society. No one suffered from want. You know, when you think about family, I mean, who among us would say to a family member, you're hungry? No, I'm not going to feed you. You're sick? No, I'm not going to take care of you. And yet, you know, here we are as a human society. I mean, we are all a human society. So, but, you know, call Jay after it's rebooted and back up again. Let's try to make it work. So the primary meme, the primary thought on the conservative side, or at least on the libertarian side, is I'm on my own. I built it. Like, I didn't get a free education at public school. I went to prep school that was paid for by my parents. So my parents built it, they would say. I did not go to a prep school. I went to public school. Thank God. At a certain point, you just have to ask, is it even possible to have that? I mean, this was the theme of the Republican National Convention. Remember, I built it. We built that. No, I built that. Was I built it? Wasn't it? I built it. And the idea, you know, Obama saying, you didn't build that. He was talking about the roads and bridges, the infrastructure necessary to make a business work. You didn't build that infrastructure. You built that business based on this country. Based on this company, on this country. And you know, everything that's here. And the difference in worldview is just startling from, you know, we're just going to, people who say that they're just going to get all they can versus people who say we're all in this together. When you think of the statistics in the United States, I mean, you know, 1% of Americans, well, actually, you know, Nick Kristof did a great piece on this. 1% of Americans have about, well, according to Bernie Sanders, 41% of all the wealth. The top 1% have 41% of all the wealth. The bottom 60% have 2.3% of the wealth. Nick Kristof wrote a column in the New York Times last week talking about, okay, what if you walked into a kindergarten and there were 100 kids? And one kid was sitting there with 99 toys. And three or four kids had one toy, and all the other kids had nothing. What would you think about that one kid who had the 99 toys? Or the 90 toys? You'd think, you know, this kid is crazy. What's wrong with this kid? This is no way to play. And yet that's the Romney rich. That's the billionaire rich. And by the way, I'm going to start referring to Romney as a billionaire. Interesting post, I believe it was in the New York Times over the weekend, about how there actually is no way to know exactly how rich Mitt Romney is. The numbers that he's required to disclose are all greater than. So his trust fund for his kids is greater than $100 million. His 401k is greater than $100 million. He claims his net wealth is greater than a quarter billion, $250 million. And so the question that you end up with is where is I'm sorry, that was just totally distracting to me. I'm sorry. So because there's no way to calculate what Mitt Romney's wealth is, it's entirely possible that he's a billionaire. In fact, when you look at people who started venture capital, vulture capital funds, private equity funds, back at the same time that Romney started Bain, when you look at his peers, all of them are billionaires. All of them are multi-billionaires, in fact. So is it possible that Romney's actually hiding the fact that he's a billionaire because he doesn't want to be the billionaire running for president, so he just makes himself a quarter millionaire? Probable, actually. So anyhow, I'm going to start referring to him as a billionaire. So he's that kid in the corner who's got all the toys, or most all the toys, and certainly the rest of America, and definitely the rest of the world, is like just, you know, stuck. They got nothing. And at what point do we call that out as mental illness? At what point do we say that's culturally destructive? At what point do we say, you know, there was a lesson to be learned from the Taino, from the Native Americans, that Columbus began the destruction of their societies and their cultures, that they made a mistake that destroyed their ecology to some significant extent, 10, 20,000 years ago. We're making that mistake now. We should learn from it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. So we can talk about, you know, Happy Columbus Day. And what would you do? What do you think should be the situation with this young man? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Joe in New York City. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I don't think that's suicide. I think preachers would probably say the same thing, because you're not killing her. She's dying naturally.
Right, but her father is of the opinion that this is suicide and therefore she's going to go to hell because she's making the decision about the time that her life will end. And Art Kaplan is saying, well, the law says that if you're already dead or dying, I mean, you're being kept alive by a machine, then turning off the machine is not, and deciding to turn off the machine is not a killing. It's not a suicide. Sure. If a person doing it, if it's somebody else doing it, it's not a killing. And that we.
Yeah, because I knew a lady who, you know, we were real close, and she was on a machine, and this was like 5-6 years ago, and she had a living will that to be on the machine, not to pull the thing. And what happened was when she was on it, she couldn't. They wouldn't take it off.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. This is a complex and difficult one. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for the call, James in Erie, Pennsylvania. Your thoughts.
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to thank you for bringing sanity to the holiday. I know you bring this up every year, and I really appreciate it.
You're talking about the Columbus Day Taino story and all that?
Yeah,
stuff? Yeah.
I know you've read from Zinn's book before, and it you know, it's changed my whole view over it over the years, and I can't stand the holiday anymore. And so thank you.
Well, I think increasingly Americans are getting it. And by the way, I've reading from my own book, actually, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, there's a whole chapter in there, or a good chunk of a chapter, about Columbus and Wetico and the American, you know, how this all came about. But Howard Zinn was on this as well, you're right.
Right. And as far as the ecology and the people and this suicide thing goes, I'm kind of, and even the vegetarian thing, I'm kind of like the Shakers, you know, didn't want to have sex to propagate the human race, and I think that's the best thing we can do for the environment, considering there's
not have sex?
Billions of us. Yeah, I mean, no, but not to have the keep adding to the problem, which I see as humans.
Yeah, well, yeah. After our third, I had a vasectomy. I was, enough of it. Louise and I were like, okay, you know, we've done our, even more than arguably, but it was. I think that the main thing, and this is the fascinating statistic, when you look at what affects population growth, there for a long, long time, the prevailing belief in America and in the scientific community and whatnot was that what was affecting population growth was things like wealth or access to birth control. Those were this was the big debate. Is it access to birth control, or is it how wealthy a society is? And the people who just, you know, wanted the corporations and consumerism to grow all across the world pointed out that as societies became wealthy, their population propagation rate dropped, their birth rate dropped, and they got closer to zero population growth, and in some, many cases even went to negative population growth. Whereas on the other hand, very poor nations were constantly reproducing like bunnies. So they said, well, we just need to bring, you know, Walmart to the world, right? And or whatever, and make people rich. And then the other argument was, no, it has to do with access to birth control. As people get wealthier, they have more access to birth control, and in those countries where there's easy access. But it turns out that there are countries where people are very rich, principally the oil-rich Emirates of the Middle East, where the average family size is still somewhere between 7 and 11 kids, even though the family is given anywhere from $10,000 to $40,000 a year free by the government simply for being a citizen. And there are countries where birth control is widely available. I mean, very widely available and free. And they're reproducing like crazy. And what it turns out is the variable, and that includes some countries in South America, or some places in South America. It turns out what the variable is the power that women have. When women have power in a society, cultural and political power, then and power within their families, and that principally that power comes from education in Western societies. When they have that power, then zero population growth happens. And even lacking money or lacking access to what we would call conventional or modern birth control. So it's James, I think, thank you for the call. At the end of the day, it really becomes an issue of how do we empower women. Steve in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Glad to get in touch with you. I know you had problems with the phone. Glad I got through.
Yeah, I am too.
Just thought I'd bring some perspective as to what they believe as far as this topic.
Are you talking about Jehovah's Witnesses, did you say?
Specifically, yes.
Okay.
As far as this woman goes, with her medical problem up in New York, the Bible, as they believe, teaches strictly against any type of suicide. So that's out of the question. But in this case, it seems like there's a question of life support actually keeping her alive. Well, when fuzzy gray matters like this, it comes down to a matter of an individual's conscience. They have to base their decision on what they understand about Bible topics.
Teachings.
And it seems like in this case, her initial reaction was that it would be okay to say, go ahead and let God's will be done, pull the plug on me, and if that should pass, and if so be it, that's God's will.
Yeah.
Of course, that being the case, she would still have hope of life in a paradise, you know, after a resurrection.
Right.
Other Christian organizations would call it, you know, maybe going to heaven, their version of it.
Is this
In this case, sounds like her parents had a different philosophy on that, and that they would rather err on the side of caution and not take the chance that that would be something that God would see, you know, disapprove of.
Yeah,
and
or her
chance for you know, life in paradise and her reward.
Yeah, or perhaps they're even taking the position that, you know, if you want to put this in a God frame, that God's will is that the machine be there, and that's part of the whole thing. But yeah, I got it, Steve. You're a former Jehovah's Witness.
That's true.
So and is this young woman a Jehovah's Witness? Is that the religion that her father's part of?
Well, just before your speaker, the author there even mentioned that, you know, there were Jehovah's Witnesses and the blood question that he had come across in cases with him.
Right.
I just assumed that that's where he was leading with it. So
right.
I can't say for sure, but
okay.
I would say that's a very good chance it is.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know for a fact. Steve, thank you for the call. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm nervous. I'm of Methodist faith. My mother is of Baptist faith. My dying brother was a Catholic.
Wow.
My brother's wishes were to go as peacefully as possible when he was dying. They induced the morphine. My mother nor I wanted to intervene on what my brother's wishes were. Mm-hmm. And I don't consider it suicide, nor do I consider it murder that we allowed it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just at peace with it, and I know my mother is as well. And again, we're all of Christian faith, whoopee, but you should respect a dying person and not want them to be in pain and suffering. I mean, I just think that is so sick.
Well, I can
people want to do that for selfish reasons, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I can tell you from personal experience, I know that there are a lot of people in the United States who are in hospice care, who are at end of life, who are within hours, maybe days, but certainly within hours of dying and in a lot of pain. And the people caring for them decide to just keep giving them morphine until they're no longer in pain, which equals when they stop breathing.
Right.
And there are more and more families confronting this because the hospice rules in most states, I believe. I don't know how it varies from state to state. Have become more flexible, shall we say, and particularly
as they should be.
Yes,
but I think it's also the person that's dying, that's going through the ills.
Mm-hmm.
That should be the person's. You should respect what their wishes are.
Right, but how do you
and
know?
That's what my mother and I did for my brother.
Right. What do you do if somebody has not left a living will, has never had that conversation with anybody, and they stroke out and they're locked in? They're conscious, but they can't move and they can't communicate.
Yeah, you got a good point.
And at that point, they're in pain, they're dying. What do you do?
I just think it's more compassionate to help them leave this world for their next adventure.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I'll be, you know, on the record, for the record, that's what I would want done with and for me. Kathy, thank you very much for the call. Ron in Denver. Hey, Ron, you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, it's working. Okay. Got a minute.
Yeah.
What's up?
My son, he fell a couple years ago and split his head, and he was put in the hospital. They cooled his body down, and they tried to shrink, you know, the swelling, and never did. Well, they shrunk the swelling, but he never did come out of the coma.
I'm sorry.
And he had talked to my ex-wife, and he had already discussed if there was ever this problem, he would want them to pull the plug.
Uh-huh. So you knew what his wishes were before.
Yeah, they knew what their wishes were before.
Yeah. That's got to
be. I just wanted to share that with you.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much. That's got to be a tough thing. Having, you know, parents are not supposed to outlive their children. It's just not. It must have been a very, very difficult thing for you. Thank you for calling and sharing.
Sure. We'll see you.
Thank you for calling and sharing the story with us. I just can't imagine. And then that's why I'm not so quick to judge this father who's this preacher who is telling his, you know, who was apparently telling his daughter that she would go to hell if they pulled the ventilator. Because it's like, how can you make any kind of decision like that if you've never experienced it? These are territories, these are areas that you just can't know until you've been there. I don't know how to say it. We'll be right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. One of our callers today is going to get a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People, sponsored by Stamps.com.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Oh, let's check on the news. The Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at donsiegelman.org. And there's also a free-don, I think it's .org. Shane is going to check it for you, and I'll let you know during the news report. Victoria Jones of Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today? Mitt Romney gave a speech.
In which he was extremely critical of the president, saying hope is not a strategy. It's been widely panned by foreign policy experts, but does that matter? It may not matter to voters who may be looking for style rather than substance. And according to a new poll released today by the Pew Research Center of likely voters, it may not matter. Mitt Romney has surged following his strong debate performance last week and holds a slight lead over President Obama among likely voters. He's more highly regarded on most personal traits and issues than he was prior to the debate, and his supporters are now more enthusiastic and engaged in the campaign. Poll also shows significant increases in the number of voters who identify as Republicans and the number of Republicans who report they're likely to vote. He leads Obama among likely voters 49% to 45%, with 6% undecided or choosing another candidate. That's a significant turnaround from the previous poll in mid-September when Obama led 51% to 43%. He also leads among white women, which Obama was leading among previously. He's basically pulled ahead in just about every category.
Wow. Okay, what else is going on?
So the significance, I think, of this is that it puts a very interesting slant on the upcoming vice presidential debate, which, in my view, is probably the most important vice presidential debate for the last 20 years.
Because?
Because I think a lot of people are going to be watching it and paying attention to it as they look to see whether Ryan is the man that they want at the side of this man who they paid attention to for the first time last week. And also attention is going to be paid to Joe Biden, who some people are already writing off as a buffoon, which he's not. But he's also coming under a lot of pressure from the Obama campaign. David Axelrod is personally overseeing his debate preparations. And he, of course, is under huge pressure not to make any mistakes in the 90 minutes. I think if he does well in this debate, he can swing the needle back enough that he can hold it for the week that he needs to until Obama debates again. If Ryan does well or if he makes errors, the needle can swing enough Romney's way that it could have the effect of really moving the election significantly.
Yeah. Yeah, this thing is a toss-up, I mean, right now. And anybody who thinks that it's in the bag on either side is just plain old flat-out wrong. And,
very much so. And
down ticket, too. I mean, I was astounded to see, you know, as President Obama's numbers started sinking in Ohio, so did Sherrod Brown's. And it's like this is, and it's not just him. I mean, it's happening with Democrats and Republicans all across the country. The Republicans are rising on the coattails of Romney. The Democrats are falling on the coattails of Obama following that debate. And, you know, speaking just for myself, hopefully that will change. But, you know, this is the nature of partisan politics in America.
Yes.
So what else is going on?
I came back from the United Kingdom late last night. So a bit of news from overseas. It is the Conservative Party conference this week. Last week it was the Labour Party conference. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, laid out his vision. He's major cuts in benefits, but also he put forward a very interesting idea, which you may see slither across the pond. He put forward the idea for a new breed of company in which workers will be forced to lose some maternity rights and all access to unfair dismissal tribunals. In other words, workers will be given shares by their employer worth between £2,000 and £50,000, and any gains in those shares would be exempt from capital gains tax. In exchange, they'd be asked to give up their rights over unfair dismissal, redundancy, and the right to request flexible working and time off for training, and they'd have to change maternity leave benefits. Now, at the moment, it would be optional, but in the future, it's anticipated that most companies, small companies, would go for this, because all they would have to do would be to give them a £2,000 bonus and effectively nothing in the future, because they wouldn't effectively be getting anything more. It's being strongly criticized by the unions, but George Osborne is being very, 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 very bearish on this, or is it bullish on this? Bullish on this. Mm-hmm. And he's putting in fast-track legislation so that firms can use the new type of contract from April 2013 so that you would have to go for this. You wouldn't have an option to go for the old form of employment. You would have to join a company under this form of employment, or the job would not be open to you.
Remarkable. What would this mean for Americans? I mean, do you see a trend here?
I just find myself wondering whether, if indeed we did have a Romney presidency, this is the kind of idea that he might pick up on.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I think you're probably right. Okay. So what else is up?
So I thought that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Also up, there's a conversation going on in Congress about the lame duck session, even though they're not in session. And Speaker Boehner is indicating that he doesn't think that a grand bargain is going to be something that can be achieved. This despite the fact that there are very, very major talks going on among senior senators and also Simpson and Bowles and people like that to try and see if they can construct some kind of grand bargain. But he's saying that he doesn't think that it can be done, or that the lame duck is the place to get it done. More or less saying that we should sort of limp forward or punt. Whether he's saying that because he's anticipating an Obama victory, or whether he's saying it because he really doesn't think that those people who have now been voted out of office should in fact try and get something done, it's not clear. But that's the latest thing that he said on the lame duck, which is highly significant because we've got sequestration coming in on January the 1st. When massive cuts are coming into the place.
Right, although they can be undone retroactively in the first few weeks. But excellent point. Victoria Jones, it's free-don.org, by the way. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, let's think about what's going on in the United States right now. I mean, everywhere you look, the profit motive is replacing the public good. Seriously, I mean, this is we created this country in order to form a more perfect union, Lincoln's phrase. For life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Jefferson's phrase. What used to be our commons, our education system, our roads, our bridges, our social safety nets, our prisons, our water and power systems, you name it, they're all being devoured by billionaires and their for-profit corporations. And they only have one motive, to make higher and higher quarterly profits. So with the privatization of water facilities in Detroit, for example, which is happening right now, I mean, there's a big battle going on with that. It's being done by one of the little emperors of Governor Snyder's. It's no longer a question of how water can be supplied to the most residents in the best way possible. It's now a question of how can the basic human need for water be used to turn a profit? With the privatization of prisons in places like Ohio and Arizona, it's no longer a question there of how can we administer our criminal justice system for the good of society, but rather the question has become how can we lock up more and more Americans to increase profits? Or Arizonans in the case of Arizona. And with the privatization of education, which can be seen in the push for charter schools and billionaire-funded Hollywood movies, you know, it's no longer a question of how can we educate our kids to be leaders in the new economy or just successful people, but rather how can we shuffle kids in and out of classes in the most profitable way possible? The Republican Party has pushed privatizing Social Security since the 30s, privatizing Medicare since the 60s. Our food supply is now increasingly dominated by one private corporation, Monsanto, that's peddling genetically modified foods that some scientific tests have shown to be unhealthy in lab animals, but are extremely profitable. Heck, there's the privatization of parking meters in Chicago and toll booths and roadways all over the nation. All around us, Wall Street, transnational corporations, and billionaires are buying up our commons, and more parts of our local neighborhoods are increasingly being run on this profit motive instead of the public good motive as they used to be. So what's the end game here? I think it's pretty obvious. A corporate state that gives no protections to the poor or the working class. A corporate state that cares little for public safety and cares a lot about profitable incarceration rates. A corporate state that treats students as profit cogs in the machine. A corporate state that turns a blind eye to profitable genetically modified terrors in our food supply. A corporate state that exhausts our long-term resources for short-term profits. This is where we're headed. And we're so far down this road already that today's generation of Americans can't, you know, the young people today can't even remember a time when it was any different. Which is why we all need to pay attention to a little nation in South Asia for salvation. That nation is Bhutan or Bhutan. I need to double check the pronunciation on that. I've heard it both ways a bunch of times. Well, and I've never talked to anybody from Bhutan. There's only six or 700,000 people there. While most countries look at economic indicators like GDP and total wealth, Bhutan does things differently. They've replaced gross domestic product, GDP, with gross national happiness, therefore determining the success not of the country, not by looking at how profitable their economy is, but instead at how happy their people are. Instead of unemployment numbers and quarterly profit targets, Bhutan relies on indicators like psychological well-being, health, education, time use, diversity, ecology, and good governance. And this new method appears to be working. Bhutan is landlocked between India and China as one of the least developed nations on the planet, but it also just so happens to be one of the happiest. Despite an average income of just $110 a month. Remember earlier we were talking about Native Americans living poor but happy? $110 a month. Business week. Business week. This isn't, you know, some lefty publication. It wasn't The Nation. It wasn't, you know, High Times. Business week ranked Bhutan as the happiest nation in Asia and the eighth happiest nation on the planet. And since Bhutan, happiness is more important than profit. Bhutan is not beholden to big transnational corporations that want to harvest that nation for profits the way Mitt Romney harvested companies. That's why Bhutan is poised to be the first nation in the world to make sure 100% of its domestic farming is organic. Over the next 10 years, Bhutan will completely phase out the use of chemicals in farming. Completely. No GMOs, no chemicals, no herbicides, no pesticides. Meanwhile, here in the United States, 70% of the food on our grocery store shelves is made with genetically modified organisms. Bhutan is going to have zero in the entire country. Can you imagine a nation without profits, but also without cancers and without the destruction of the soil? Some will say it's a lot easier to set up something like gross national happiness in a place like Bhutan that has only a population of about 700,000 people, about the size of Portland, Oregon, and its suburbs. But just because Bhutan is small, that doesn't mean we should ignore their ideas. Some people think it's revolutionary to say that a government should serve all the people and not just those with the money to hire a lobbyist. They'd say it's naive to have radical things as a goal for a government's existence. Silly, unprofitable things like life or liberty or, get this, the pursuit of happiness. But I think it's a good idea. I think it's something that would make our founders proud. And I have to say, it sure looks to me and sounds to me and feels to me like, you know, you've heard for 9 years, you've been hearing me talk about the cancer stage of capitalism, that we are looking at, well, first, we're looking at the cancer stage of capitalism, at the end game in laissez-faire capitalism, in libertarian capitalism, in Romney capitalism. It is a cancer. It's an economic cancer. And, you know, the good news is that when economies die, they get rebooted. They get reincarnated. They get restarted. Right now in the United States, there are more people working for companies that they themselves own, worker-owned businesses, cooperatives, like Union Cab in Madison, Wisconsin. There's more people working for worker-owned companies than there are unionized workers in this country. Now, tragically, both those numbers are, you know, less than 10% of the population. But, well, unionized workers, if you include government employees, a little over 10%. But still, it's in that neighborhood. It used to be a third before Reagan. But I see this as, like, really good news, frankly, that we could be looking at this kind of end of the cancer stage of capitalism. I'm frankly very optimistic about that. So, and Bhutan, says Shano. No, it's all right. Well, yeah, sure. Go ahead and play it. You've got, here's the pronouncer.
Bhutan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pronouncer. Whose pronouncer was that? Inoglio, Inoglo, okay. Yeah, great. English pronunciation, good. So the question is, what do you replace capitalism with? I don't think Marxism worked out all that well, but I do think that democratic socialism, capital D, capital S, democratic socialism, which works so well in Norway, for example, right now, which just gave fathers 14 weeks of vacation pay, or not vacation pay, paternity pay, paid paternity leave, if they have a child, in Sweden, in Denmark, in Finland, that those countries that have gone down the road toward democratic socialism have found that, you know, they're not sinking with the rest of Europe. They have their own currencies. They have their own economies. They're not in crisis. They're not in recession or depression. They're doing well. And it's those countries that have given in to the transnational corporate imperative, one of which was the EU. It was created by transnational corporations. They pushed it. And the other is going on right here. That's where the problem is.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we need to stop listening to these transnational corporations and their shills and start paying attention to building a nation and economy that works for everybody. So Mitt Romney, speaking of saving the world, Mitt Romney, who wants to aspire to the job of being one of the most powerful people on planet Earth, just gave a major foreign policy speech, or at least what was billed as a major foreign policy speech. I have not heard it. I will tell you, I've read excerpts from it. I've seen the word cloud over at Daily Kos. He mentioned Latin America once, mentioned Russia once, didn't mention China, mentioned the Middle East a lot. But let's talk to somebody who actually knows about national security. Doug Wilson is on the line with us. He was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for the United States of America for Public Affairs until April of 2012. And now he's a member of the Obama campaign's National Security Advisory Committee. BarackObama.com, of course, is the website. Doug, welcome to our program.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I'm sure that not only did you watch the speech, listen to the speech, read the speech, but you did so with a well-informed eye. What's your take on what Governor Romney had to say today?
Disappointment. This is the third or fourth, if not more, reset. This is the latest kind of foreign policy speech of the week. And I'm saddened and I'm confused. I have to tell you, Tom, this is the first time in my lifetime that a Democrat has been preferred over a Republican when asked in polls, who do you prefer as commander-in-chief? This has been a consistent answer
with regard to national
campaign. You've seen it in Fox polls. You've seen it in MSNBC polls, in all polls. And I think there's reasons for that. And I think that Governor Romney just showed yet again why that is the preference.
Can you give me some specifics as to why?
Yes, I think that President Obama has shown that he will be tough, and has proven that he will be tough and stand up for American interests and values, but that he will also be smart in doing so. And I think the American people understand that. I think they understand we're operating not in the 20th century, but in the 21st. Mm-hmm. I think they understand that after 8 years on the battlefield, it no longer suffices to basically put foreign policy in terms of us versus them, beat our chests, and lead the country off a cliff. We hear inconsistencies and rhetoric from Governor Romney without any specifics. We hear him talking about a strong military. He makes false accusations about President Obama supposedly weakening the military. Well, I was at the Pentagon, and I saw the nation's generals and admirals work with political leaders to come up with the soundest strategy for the 21st century and tie spending to that strategy rather than just make meat axe cuts across the board without tying those cuts to strategy, or saying that they're, like Governor Romney has, that he'll spend 4% of GDP on the military. You know how much that is, Tom? $2 trillion. The military hasn't asked for $2 trillion over the next 10 years, and Governor Romney hasn't said what he'd spend it on. In fact, I have to say that having heard this speech today, I think Governor Romney ought to check his hearing, because I think what we're getting is bombast, and we're getting cheap shots of political opportunism, and I think he's become tone-deaf on what the country's looking for in a commander-in-chief. I think the polls show that.
We can discuss the polls, and you're using a lot of adjectives, but I'm curious specifically what, and I'm on your side. I'm curious specifically, what did Governor Romney say today that you take issue with and that we all should be paying attention to and scratching our heads about?
Governor Romney still criticizes the president's timeline in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. even though he says he'd pursue it now as president. Governor Romney talks about the attacks in Benghazi, when in fact his immediate response to Benghazi was the most blatant example of political opportunism I can remember in a long time. He talked about the Arab Spring, and he talked about the need to tie our aid to Egypt to democracy progress. We've done that. He talked about the need now to make sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon, which is precisely the policy of this administration. He said it was tragic to bring our troops home from Iraq, but he has no he didn't say would he keep our troops in Iraq. He hasn't said what he would do with regards to our troops in Afghanistan. He's criticized the president for establishing a timeline to bring them home by 2014. And then he's also criticized the president for bringing them home too soon. Mm-hmm. What will he do with our troops? He should say that to the American public.
So it sounds like, in summary, what you're saying, Doug Wilson, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, it sounds like what you're saying is that Mitt Romney's doing the same thing with international, with foreign affairs, international policy that he did with domestic policy, which is to say, essentially not using these words, of course, those parts of what the president has done that are popular and that everybody likes, I'm doing that too. I'm suggesting the exact same thing. I'm just calling it something different and claiming it's my brand. And those things that are not so popular or that are difficult or that are complicated, I'm going to speak about in vague generalities and not give any specifics about, and basically just trust me and make me president.
I would not only agree with you, but I'd go further. I'd go further and say, it's like the Wizard of Oz, Tom, and we need to pull the curtain back and not ignore the man behind the curtain, and we need to ask some questions. We need to ask, who speaks for him? Hmm. Is it John Bolton, you know, who would have us go to war in Iraq and Syria? If Governor Romney thinks we need to be going to war in Iraq, in Iran, in Syria, he should say so and tell the American public.
Right.
Is it John Lehman who would be spending billions more on ships that aren't needed anymore? If they want to know what a strategy is for the Navy, they ought to ask the admirals who lead the Navy, who are part of developing the spending plan tied to a coherent strategy for the 21st century that was presented in President Obama's most recent budget proposal.
Excellent point. Doug, we're out of time, but thank you for being with us today. Doug Wilson.
Thank you.
BarackObama.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day in just a moment. The good, the bad, and the very, very galleanthropically ugly. The good. Former Congressman Tom Tancredo of Colorado, who used to be on our program quite a bit. While there will most likely be no mention of marijuana legalization in the next two presidential debates, it's a hot issue around the country, including in Colorado, where there is a ballot initiative to legalize the drug. The initiative has a great deal of support, including from Tancredo, who is a former Colorado representative and a prominent Republican. Marijuana legalization has also received support from another prominent Republican, Washington State U.S. Senate candidate Michael Baumgartner. He recently endorsed Washington State's marijuana legalization ballot initiative. The fact that Republicans are starting to come aboard the marijuana legalization platform is saying something, and it's time for those in Washington to listen. The bad. Congressman Scott Tipton. Tipton, a Republican, was asked by Think Progress reporters what he thought about nuns on a bus, a group of nuns that is traveling the country campaigning against Paul Ryan's austerity budget. Tipton's response? Well, he wrote the nuns off as a group of people, quote, who want to try and divide America. Tipton also said that the nuns lack the understanding of how to pay for federal programs. Tipton's comments are interesting, especially considering that Republicans in Washington are doing all they can to help the wealthy elite prosper and leave the middle class in the dust. Now, Congressman Tipton, who's really trying to divide America? And the very, very ugly Robert Murray. Remember when Mitt Romney talked about coal in the debate last week?
And by the way, I like coal. I'm going to make sure we can continue to burn clean coal. People in the coal industry feel like it's getting crushed by your policies.
So why is Romney looking out for the interests of big coal so much? Because he gets a lot of money from it, and especially from Robert Murray's Murray Energy, one of the largest coal mining operations in America. According to a piece in the New Republic, Murray all but coerces his employees into donating to Republican political campaigns and threatens to cut their bonuses or demote them if they don't. The New Republic also notes that Murray Energy has contributed $120,000 to Romney's campaign already this year and contributed a total of $1.4 million to other Republicans, including Scott Brown, Rand Paul, and James Inhofe. It's bad enough that Murray is at the helm of a company that's actively destroying our environment, but threatening his employees if they don't make favorable political campaign contributions? Now that is very, very ugly.
That's very, very ugly.
Oh, my. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Carol in Hemet, California. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
Ooh, big question. Huawei, telecommunications there.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they coming to the U.S. instead of a factory when our wages are higher? What trans-Pacific partnership goodies are they being offered?
I don't know.
Really
the big concern that was expressed by the, I believe it was the Department of Defense earlier,
right.
It's reported in the New York Times, is that this is a company that is owned by or has strong ties to the Chinese military. And they're very concerned. I mean, the Chinese military owns a lot of businesses. China's business model is not so much like ours, not so entrepreneurial. There are a lot of state-owned enterprises, or the state is a major partner in these enterprises, particularly large strategic enterprises.
And there's the concern that if all of our phone systems are owned by the government of China and China decides that they don't like the way we're behaving, say, with regard to Taiwan or with regard to trade or with regard to, you know, oil in Africa, or if I fill in the blank, that they could just turn off all our phones. And so there's a, you know, there's a serious concern here. Carol, thank you for calling and raising it. I mean, this is a big deal. And the question isn't so much, you know, bad China, you know, freak out. It's, do you want any country that owns part of businesses whose military is involved with those businesses to be running the telecommunications infrastructure of the United States? I'd be just as concerned about Canada, frankly, or not just as concerned, but I think that it would be appropriate to be concerned about any other country. This should be domestic. Jim in Camino Island, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Jim.
Hi,
what's
Tom.
On your mind?
I'm a recovering engineer, so I tend to think of things in technical terms.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if it's possible for the human race to live sustainably with electricity, given all the mining and the industrial processes that involved.
Well, given that heat and light and increasingly ultraviolet, but visible light certainly, physical motion like wind and wave, all those things can be converted into electricity with increasing efficiency. I mean, just 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about the, I'm not aware of any mine that's sustainable. You spoke earlier about the, you know, our waste products not being inputs for other things.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking about the process that makes our wires.
Yeah, the tipping point.
Beneficial for something else.
The tipping point will be when a solar panel can produce, or an array of solar panels can produce enough electricity that an identical array of solar panels can be basically reprocessed, can be recycled, using the energy from an equal number of solar
panels. What about
the
land that was destroyed to make the solar panels in the first place?
Well, I mean, look around you. Every building that you see is made out of dirt, basically, you know, cement.
Exactly.
So,
that's what concerns me.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple million years ago, we learned to control fire, and that gave us our big brains.
Yeah, it was a couple hundred thousand years ago, actually. But, yeah.
Well,
well, it depends on how you define we. I mean, the human race is arguably only 165,000 years old.
I'm talking about where we came down out of the trees and started living on the ground and whatnot.
But your point, regardless of the years, your point is well made.
Right. And so as you point out, some civilizations have learned to live with fire sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
Not all that many. And so is it possible for anything other than Stone Age to live, you know, for thousands of years to where our actions are actually benefiting the land base.
Right. Well, the jury's out. And, I mean, you know, this is, you could go back and look at the Incans or the Mayans. There's a lot of civilizations that rose up and destroyed their environment.
Right.
It looks like the Incan civilization actually collapsed as a result of influenza brought by the Spanish conquistadors.
Right.
But
Pacific Northwest civilizations lived for tens of thousands of years.
Stable.
You know, basically part of the salmon cycle.
Yeah, stable and prosperous. You're absolutely right. Jim, Shane tells me that you're the call who is going to get a free copy of an autographed copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, brought to you by Stamps.com. So hang on the line. And Shane, you can tell Danielle that he's on line one. Johnny in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I really consider your opinion, so I'm very, very astonished to hear and to see. I mean, I watched the debate and listened to the program for a while. How come politicians don't really ask a direct question to the other politician? And I think
because it's banned by the rules of the debate. The only kind of question that a politician is able to ask another politician, Romney and Obama, in these rules for these debates, the only way that they can ask each other a question is to ask it rhetorically. They can say, what would a president do if, you know, Colombia decided to bomb Nicaragua? But they can't say, what would you do? And they can't say, will you please tell me what you think a president should do? You can't ask a direct question.
No, what I mean is, like, you can make a direct fact. Like, the, for example, this this lady that called earlier and asked, she was giving a testimony. She worked for this company that being taken over by Bain, by a Chinese corporation.
Is,
they're being obligated to teach them the deal and everything else. Why didn't Obama just look at Romney and say, hey, right now at this second, a company from China is being taken over through your company, through Bain, from to an American company.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say about it?
Right.
I mean,
well, he couldn't ask that question,
but
he could make that statement. And I'm with you, Johnny. I think that he should have been more aggressive. He should have been more direct and more blunt, and he should have been more energetic. And I suspect he will be next time around. You know, hope springs eternal here. Cora in Taos, New Mexico. Cora, we have a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Well, I was just wondering about the fourth dream by Strauss and his co-author. Mm-hmm. Could you spoil it for us and tell us the ending?
Well, the ending is that the cycles continue.
I know, but how does it turn from this to the next?
With an economic collapse and a world war.
Ah, not good.
Well, you know, good, not good. I think that we started into that economic collapse. Obama pulled us back from the edge of it. I still think it's coming. I think that we haven't corrected the we haven't corrected the fundamentals. You know, our system, our economic system is still broken. It's still controlled by the banksters and the billionaires, and they will crash it. They will absolutely crash it. You know, as soon as they have an opportunity, and I expect that's going to be in the next 5 years, and probably in the next three or four. And then when that happens, when we're really in trouble and the rest of the world is really in trouble, that typically causes wars, and you know we're and certainly brings out the warmongers in the defense industry. I mean, look at Romney now talking about you know we've got to have a war. You know, well, he didn't say we've got to have a war, but he's basically been promoting wars. And then the generation that experiences that depression and that war says, okay, enough of this nonsense. And for the next 60 years or so, as long as they're alive and have something to say about it, you don't get that. And then 80 years down the road, it reboots.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The book, by the way, that Cora was mentioning is a book that I've talked about many times in the program, The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard, spoken like a good Canadian, right? Broderick Johnson is with us. He's with the Barack Obama campaign, senior advisor to the Obama for America campaign, BarackObama.com, of course. Broderick, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Tell me about the campaign's ground game. What are you guys doing?
Well, you know, we've had a ground game that really is an extension of what we did in 2008. So we've got offices that we've maintained and also continue to build on since that campaign. So throughout the states, all the states really, but especially in these battleground states, we've got hundreds of offices and thousands of volunteers making phone calls, going door to door, making sure people understand the choice that we face in really just 4 weeks from now.
How would you define that choice?
Well, you know, it really is a choice between, first of all, two different visions for the country, especially economic visions. Mitt Romney's, which is a double down on trickle down. We know what that means. We saw that. We saw the devastation that caused throughout, you know, the eight years before this president took office. That's one vision. The other vision, of course, is the president's vision, which is to build out the middle class and to invest in the middle class, invest in education and job creation and making sure that the middle class really continues to go forward and to benefit from this economy. Very stark difference.
You know,
that's just in the economic world.
Sure. One of the things that astounds me is that there are so many, quote, undecided voters in America, so many people who just are not paying attention to the things that are going to influence their lives, their future, their children's future, their grandchildren's future, you know, fill in the blanks, that this I sometimes it's like banging my head against the wall. This election should be so easy. You know, this should be so obvious. Are you a billionaire? Great. Vote for Romney. Right. If you're the kind of billionaire who thinks that you should be able to hang on to all of your billions, every single penny ever made forever, and you owe nothing to anybody and to hell with the rest of the country, vote for Romney. If you're an American and you believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you want to see, you know, the country grow, vote for Obama. And yet, you know, one kind of off debate, and all of a sudden the polls are swinging. I guess it's to be expected. But how do we better educate our electorate?
Well, first, let me say that, you know, as someone repeated to me last week, so polls don't vote, people vote. And so, you know, we can't be fixated on the way these polls go up and down. And they have been, although it's been fairly, you know, some polls, of course, have been all over the place, but it's been fairly steady. We are a deeply divided country, unfortunately. And this president, though, has done so much to try to bring the country together against forces that really want to keep the country divided. Tom, we just have to keep telling people what the choices that they face, not just in terms of policy, but also in terms of really of character and vision. You know, it was shocking, really, to many people last week that Mitt Romney was willing to stand on that debate stage and be really dishonest about really about the things that he's campaigned for as he fought to get the Republican nomination. And then I guess had that Etch-a-Sketch moment, which he decided he would use that debate format. And so what we've been trying to do, and people need to understand, is that Mitt Romney in so many ways was dishonest about things that he has said he would support, and that we really ought to take him at his word if he were elected president, he would do. So we just have to, and you've seen this, we have to continue, your show is important for this, to tell people really what the differences are and what Mitt Romney, on the one hand stands for and the other he doesn't, but that kind of dishonesty has no place in the Oval Office.
We went back and looked at the Carter-Reagan debate and pulled out a series of quotes from Ronald Reagan where he was making statements about, you know, clean coal, and he was talking, you know, it was just, I don't remember the whole list of them. It was early last week. And then found Mitt Romney saying virtually the same thing in the debate against President Obama. There was a leak out of the Romney campaign about five or six days before the debate, that actually it was more like a week and a half, that Romney was going to use a Jimmy Carter strategy, and everybody thought that had to do with foreign policy, and that his criticism around Benghazi was that's what he was talking about. But you know, Reagan basically told the same lies, and I'm thinking, you know, the Romney people looked at that debate and said, hey, Reagan got away with lying, we can get away with lying. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think Mitt Romney is no Ronald Reagan, so let's sort of stipulate that.
That's a good line.
Right. And, I mean, there are many things that I disagreed with Ronald Reagan about, but he certainly was a different kind of leader. But, you know, Mitt Romney, and he gave this foreign policy speech today, and it was much, you know, much ballyhooed and much anticipated, but he did the same thing that he did last week, which is that he demonstrated that he just can't, his veracity really just can't be relied on. He'll say one thing after another. He really will sort of, you know, just sort of flippantly say certain things. You can't have that as a commander in chief. You absolutely can't have that. Again, whether it's regarding domestic policy, or foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't, for example, you know, take this knee-jerk reaction with regard to the tragedy that happened in Libya. And you can't say things like it was tragic that we brought American troops home from Iraq. And you can't say on the one hand that we, you know, we should have a two-state solution in the Middle East, but then on the other, and you know, sort of that closed door, that infamous closed door session with those with those contributors, say you really don't believe in that process anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to make sure people understand that, you know, what when he talks about foreign policy, when he talks about, you know, whether he's in favor of a $5 trillion tax cut or that's his proposal and then tries to deny it, do people understand it? No, no, no. This is the true Mitt Romney. You got to understand what he has said. You got to take him at his word.
Well,
it can be ever shifting.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, I think that you should be using the attacks against him about Mitt the flip-flopper that the Republicans were using. But Broderick Johnson, senior advisor of the Obama for America campaign, BarackObama.com. Thank you, Broderick. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure talking with you. Good
luck. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, privatizing the commons, corporatized schools, water, big moneymaker, prisons for profit. I'll challenge Adrian Moore of Reason Magazine, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Actually show up. Not just vote. Show up. Get out there. Get active and occupy something. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.